This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From the Marketplace crime blotter today, a little bit of insider trading. Also, BlackBerry from the company's possibly back from the dead department. And the funniest man on Twitter. It's official. His name is Rob Delaney. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 4th of November. Good to have you with us. You know, we talk a lot about trading on this program, and we talk about Wall Street insiders every now and then. But if you roll those two together, the insiders and the trading parts, things can get ugly and expensive in a hurry. Today, a high-profile New York hedge fund called SAC Capital confessed to the aforementioned insider trading and got smacked with a $1.2 billion fine. SAC is the first Wall Street firm in years to own up to actual criminal conduct. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gives us the insider's view.
Insider information is knowledge of an event that's going to affect a company's stock price. Things like bankruptcies, a merger with another company, a drug getting approved or not. Lance John Kimmel is a securities attorney with SEC law firm.
If some people have access to information that other investors don't have, they know whether to buy a stock or sell a stock. If we allowed that, we would have a massive collapse of confidence in our market system.
SAC admitted to getting earnings information from a mole at Dell Computers. The hedge fund used that information to decide whether or not to buy Dell stock, which helped it make more than $1 million. Donald Langvoort is a law professor at Georgetown University. He says it's not always clear what makes information insider.
If what they know is not material, simply interesting, maybe the kind of thing that if you patch it together with various other facts gives you insight, that's perfectly legal.
For instance, if Dell had retail stores, it wouldn't be illegal for a worker to say those stores had seen more foot traffic. It would be illegal to tell the hedge fund that increase in foot traffic meant a higher quarterly profit. John Coffey is a law professor at Columbia University. He says heavy fines imposed on insider traders are working, but sometimes the temptation is just too great.
Definitely it will discourage. It will never stop it. There are always risk takers, and sometimes you're getting a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to profit.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
As I squeezed into my seat on the plane to New York this morning, I looked over at the guy next to me, and I honestly did a double take because he was beavering away on his BlackBerry, which is something you just don't see much of anymore. Things have been going so poorly for that company that there was serious consideration of a plan to take it private. We learned today, though, that that deal is off. Instead, BlackBerry is getting a $1 billion investment and a new CEO, and probably crossing its fingers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers what keeps BlackBerry in business.
For about 7 years, Joanna Kasdan was a loyal customer of BlackBerry. A few months ago, that changed.
My last BlackBerry sort of died. It wasn't holding its charge. It was clearly time to let go of it. And rather than get another one knowing that the company was in trouble, I got an Android.
She didn't want to invest in a company that could go bust. Other consumers prefer all the apps available on other smartphones. Still, Kasdan says she didn't want to give up her old BlackBerry.
I resisted because I liked the touch feel of the keyboard on BlackBerry, and I still miss that.
BlackBerry has tried to go head-to-head with the touchscreen phones, but it's BlackBerry's physical keyboard that keeps consumers hooked. It also has an advantage in terms of its power supply. Jim Moorman is an equity analyst at S&P Capital IQ.
A lot of phones struggle to make it through the day. BlackBerries have no trouble doing that. So that's another key focus for business users.
Another thing business users care about? Security. Moorman says BlackBerry beats the competition when it comes to protecting against viruses. If BlackBerry builds on its strengths, he says it could maintain a solid base of customers.
They have a chance to be a niche provider, but they do also have a lot of work to do.
Investors aren't waiting to see if the company turns itself around. They've been selling off the stock in a hurry. Today, shares of BlackBerry fell more than 16%. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Elsewhere on Wall Street today, meh. Yeah, you know, whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just because the city of Detroit has filed for bankruptcy protection, which it did back in the middle of July, does not mean that it can have bankruptcy protection. There's a very high-profile trial going on right now over whether Detroit is actually eligible for the leverage that a bankruptcy petition would give the city over its creditors who wants to get out from under pension and other debt obligations. Even if that does happen, though, the city is still going to have a huge job on its hands fixing its neglected infrastructure. From Michigan Radio, Sarah Hewlett walks us through it.
Take the city's buses, for example. Getting ready to walk to the bus stop. I've lived in Detroit for 14 years and never taken the bus. Detroit's buses are notorious for being late and breaking down. But the bus I get on to take me downtown shows up pretty much on schedule. Things go pretty well, till we get a couple stops into the trip. By then, the bus is full, and a woman in a wheelchair gets left on the curb because there's no room for her. Takara Reeves says this kind of thing happens all the time, and it's cost her three jobs.
Your employer only want to hear the bus broke down, or the bus was late, or the bus didn't come so many times before they think, well, you know, you just don't want to come to work, and it's not like that.
In fact, no one I talk to is happy with the city's bus service.
It's the worst in the world. I've been there for 64 years.
That's William Tennant.
It takes too long. That's the biggest complaint. And they're nasty.
There are two basic functions in city government that are broken.
Gary Brown is Detroit's new COO. He says on any given day, about a third of the city's workforce is out sick. That's the first thing.
Secondly, we don't fix vehicles well. No kind of vehicle. We don't fix buses. Right now, I have 400 buses. Only 200 of them work. I need 300 in order to operate.
Brown says the city's bringing in a company that will investigate whether workers are actually sick. And vehicle maintenance for buses, ambulances, police cars, everything is going to get outsourced. Another city service that's getting an overhaul is street lighting. Ken Stahl is with Corby Energy. It's a firm that's surveying Detroit's 88,000 lights. Stahl has fancy gear that records the location and condition of each light.
It's going to ask me what the condition of the arm that I'm looking at is. We're just looking to see if it's bent or damaged in any way.
The problems are pretty obvious. Something like half the city's streetlights don't work. Bulbs are broken, poles are falling down, and copper wire's been stolen. Otis Jones is in charge of a new public lighting authority that's supposed to fix those problems over the next 3 years. He says the challenge is not an engineering one.
My second day on the job, the city went and filed bankruptcy. And so, you know, the task at hand is, you know, how do you finance improvements to our lighting system?
Jones says despite the bankruptcy, he's confident the bond markets will lend the authority the money it needs to fix the lights. That would make Shamika Smith happy. She says kids in her neighborhood have to walk to school in the dark.
It's just not safe. And I'm understanding, like, we're paying all these tax dollars and we don't have working streetlights. I'm not understanding what the problem is with the city.
The problem, of course, is that the city is broke. Bankruptcy should take the pressure off, but it won't help Detroit with what could be a bigger challenge. The city's got lights, roads, and infrastructure for 2 million people, but the population and the tax base is less than half that now. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
Janis Joplin gets a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame today, more than 43 years after she died. Lest you think the sidewalk tiles lining Hollywood Boulevard are all in the name of honoring artists for their lasting works, here's Alex Schmidt.
Teenage girls scream, and tourists of all nationalities snap photos along the Walk of Fame. Daniel Aruajo was thrilled when he noticed Matt Damon's star underfoot.
Well, Hollywood's magic for all people in my generation. I grew up seeing movies from Hollywood in Brazil, and that's my childhood, my adolescence.
But when I told him that getting a star on the Walk of Fame means paying the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce $30,000, he didn't find it so magical.
You're breaking all my dreams now.
Movie studios, fan clubs, or anyone can raise the funds for a star. That $30,000 goes to the Hollywood Chamber, which uses the fee for installation and upkeep. But it's not just money behind the scenes. Seeing your idol's name in brass and pink terrazzo is all about timing, too, says Amy Kaufman, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times.
A lot of times the average person might not connect that, you know, you're seeing a picture of Julianne Moore getting a Walk of Fame star and that her movie Carrie is coming out in a couple of weeks. But the studios put a lot of effort into timing these things just right. So it seems like a publicity blitz.
Kaufman says the buzz surrounding a star dedication could likely be worth millions of dollars in marketing exposure. Here's the thing. The Hollywood Chamber of Commerce doesn't hide that this is a marketing tactic. Anna Martinez has run Walk of Fame operations for 2 decades.
It's hype. Hollywood is all about hype. We help promote our community, and this is the way we do it, and it brings a big tourist group.
Every year, the chamber gets 200 to 300 submissions and picks around 20 stars out of that. Janis Joplin's family nominated her. The star dedication is timed to coincide with a Broadway musical about the singer's life, A Night with Janis. Back on the boulevard, Joplin's famous tune, Me and Bobby McGee, blares out the front door of a packed Irish-themed bar during happy hour. Love this scene or hate it, the Hollywood hype machine works. Over 10 million people visit the Walk of Fame every year. I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you have to parlay it as quickly as possible into other more, you know, brick and mortar opportunities.
Twitter fame can be fleeting, you guys. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here's where we are. Wall Street kind of kept up the momentum today. The Dow Industrials tacked on 23 points, about a 10th percent, closed at 15,639. The NASDAQ added 14 points, a 3rd percent, ended at 3936. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 3/10 percent, closed at 1767. Breakfast brand Kellogg announced Project K. No, it's not a new cereal. It's a plan to cut its global workforce by 7%. Kellogg shares, snap, crackle, and popped up 0.7%. Today, Johnson & Johnson dropped a 3%. That after agreeing to plead guilty to a misdemeanor in the marketing of Risperdal. That's an antipsychotic medication. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.6%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. President Obama is scheduled to visit Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. A Senate subcommittee on conservation, forestry, and natural resources discusses wildfires. And she uttered those famous words, "After all, tomorrow is another day." Actress Vivian Leigh was born 100 years ago on November 5th, and she got an Oscar for that one. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. As you heard up in the numbers, big layoffs at Kellogg today, 7% of its workforce, about 2,200 people. company is trying to cut costs and boost its profits, the standard state of affairs when big layoffs are announced. All of it because cereal just isn't selling the way it used to, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill tells us.
Cereal got its start as a health food, a super convenient health food. You don't have to cook your breakfast anymore, just pour it. But today, cereal is a drag. We want to be free of the tyranny of spoons. Brian Yarborough is an analyst at Edward Jones.
Today, you've got, you know, the splurge of breakfast bars and then these, you know, these breakfast sandwiches that you can throw in a microwave and they're heated up in a minute and then you're in your car eating it.
We want to multitask our breakfast.
That saves you 15 minutes in the morning.
Or five if you scarf cereal the way I do. Our inability to sit to eat is one of Kellogg's problems, leading to a 2% decline in sales of breakfast foods. Another issue, say analysts, is that Kellogg needs to innovate to keep up. Show us a little sparkle in the cereal aisle. Erin Lash is an analyst at Morningstar.
There has been further innovation in other breakfast categories. So yogurt has been a category where there's been a lot of innovation.
Those yogurt guys are always so ahead of the curve. Kellogg's innovation is probably not going to be tropical marshmallow-flavored Special K. Jeffrey Cohen is a cereal analyst with Ibis World. He expects we'll see more
cereals that are enhanced with fiber,
protein,
cereals that are full of grains,
cereals that adults want to eat. And Kellogg's knows that for some people, a bowl of cereal just isn't going to happen. So they've introduced other products like Kellogg's To Go, a spoon-free breakfast shake. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The Army announced not too long ago that it's going to cut ROTC programs. That's the Reserve Officer Training Corps. It's going to cut them at 13 universities over the next 2 years. 13 universities that are mostly in the South. The Army cited shifting demographics as a key reason for that change. So from Florence, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports on what that means locally.
It is people skills that we're working with, okay? We talk about communicating. These are things that you've got to do as an officer and a leader. You've got to communicate.
This classroom at the University of North Alabama smells new. That's because it kind of is. The entire ROTC building was renovated just this summer. Jose Atencio teaches military science here at the university.
They came in and repainted, redid the floors, and put in new windows as well as new software and computers here.
And so when the Army decided to cut the school's ROTC program, everyone was shocked, even University President William Cale.
The university has been very supportive of ROTC, and this came completely out of the blue. We had no inkling, no warning, no opportunity to respond to whatever concerns the Army had about the program.
Those concerns are that the program isn't graduating enough commissioned officers. The ROTC program started here in 1948, but the small university struggled to produce more than a handful of lieutenants each year. The Army's not okay with those numbers.
We responded to that. The university put its own scholarship money into the program. We renovated their facility. We built a $50,000 rappelling tower and did everything we could do to make the ROTC program viable.
Still, no dice. The Army will shift $4.1 million into other ROTC programs. An Army spokesman told me the new plan is to focus on underrepresented parts of the country. We're talking places like New York City, Chicago, Texas, and New Mexico. Doug Letterman is editor at Inside Higher Ed. He says for the schools losing their ROTC programs, the ripple effect can be huge.
It's likely to have real impact on student choice, on where students feel like they can go to school and get some of their education paid for.
Cadets in their junior and senior year will be allowed to finish out the program. But freshmen and sophomore cadets, like the ones in Jose Atencio's class at the University of North Alabama, are scrambling to come up with a plan B. Take Alyssa Primo, a sophomore here. Her dad and his six brothers all served in the military. She chose this program because it was close to her family, and she got a scholarship. But it didn't come easy.
I had cancer when I was younger, and so I had to get a medical waiver to be here.
She decided to switch schools to stay in an ROTC program. But all sorts of questions flooded her mind. Would she have to reapply for another medical waiver? Could she keep her scholarship?
And I was worried that, you know, I have to go through more paperwork. Would I have to do more stuff for that?
The Army says it'll honor scholarships at other schools. Next year, Primo will transfer to the University of Alabama, about 2.5 hours south of here. Jose Atencio says there will be a huge hole in this little town where military service is passed on from generation to generation. He quotes a colleague of his.
You can love the Army all you want, but it's not necessarily going to love you back. It is a business, and I understand that. But there's more to closing an ROTC when you talk about community.
The community is fighting back, urging lawmakers to reverse the Army's decision. For now, the platoon drills go on.
If you guys remember back to what Gooch taught you guys at the FTX.
2 miles off campus at a city park, ROTC students are camped out in the woods in camo, crouched around trees.
So we ready to roll? Patrol leader, you ready?
Even the cadets who won't be finishing the program at the University of North Alabama haven't given up hope and are still soldiering on. In Florence, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Stand-up comedy is a notoriously hard slog. It's all about getting up in front of as many people as you can, as often as you can, almost wherever you can. But there is a comedian out there who, after years of in-person stand-up, has gotten almost a million fans, 952,242 last time I checked, from the comfort of his own living room with jokes of 140 characters or less. Rob Delaney got famous on Twitter, and now he has gotten a book deal out of that. It's called Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage, which we will talk about later. But first, Rob, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
There are a zillion ways I could start this interview, but I am going to start, since you are a Twitter personality of note, I have to start with your avatar picture.
Yes.
That bathing suit thing that you're wearing in that picture?
Yes. It angers.
What? Yeah.
It angers certain people. It brings pleasure to others.
Okay. I'm bewildered. Give me the quick backstory.
It's a bathing suit that I do genuinely own, but when I wear it, I don't wear it around like a monster.
It's a little Speedo-y thing,
we should
say.
Yes, it is.
With what? Blue swirl?
I don't know. Like fractals. It's like weird geometric, some space storm. But I wear it under my wetsuit because I live near the beach and I like to swim in the winter. And so you can't really fit a big pair of trunks under there. So that calls for the Speedo. And a friend of mine I was getting ready to put on my wetsuit and he said, hold it right there, and took a picture.
Man. It kind of plays into this whole thing of you as this. Well, I mean, you're officially the funniest guy on Twitter, according to Comedy Central.
They were kind enough to designate me that, yeah.
Can you make a living being a Twitter star, though?
No, certainly not. You have to parlay it as quickly as possible into other more, you know, brick and mortar opportunities. Like, fortunately, I was doing live stand-up for a long time before Twitter showed up. So Twitter has allowed me to sell tickets to my live shows,
yeah.
And you can make a living doing that, certainly, thank goodness. But making money just by tweeting, I don't think you can do that unless you're already fabulously wealthy, like a Kardashian or something, and then they pay you to tweet.
They pay you to tweet. Tell me how you did that, though. How did you parlay the Twitter thing, or how did you take the Twitter thing and help it make you make money?
In the beginning, we all thought it was like a mass text service,
yeah.
You know, where
yeah.
And you could say, like, I'm at Arby's, you know, and who wants to know that? Not me. And so but then myself and other comedians realized fairly early on, oh, this is for jokes.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that comedians think it's for jokes because journalists think it's for news.
Right, and they're wrong. No, they're not wrong. Here's the thing.
Man.
The thing is there's no right way to use it. You know, even if you do want to use your Twitter to say, like, I just had a great sandwich, you know, that's okay. You're allowed to do that.
Here is the question, though. Twitter, 140 characters, famously.
Yeah.
This book is more than 140 characters.
Yeah, it is.
Tell me the story of, what's her name, Julie Grau?
Julie Grau,
You got a tweet from her one day?
Spiegel and Grau, yeah. She tweeted me one day and she said, will you write me a book?
And I wrote back, sure, ha ha, and then forgot about it. And then an author who she does publish, an amazing guy named Matt Johnson, wrote me and he said, hey, man, you need to actually pay attention to that. You need to follow up on that. She doesn't just cavalierly be like, hey, write me a book. I'm an actual real publisher. Write, do the thing that I do.
Yeah.
And so I wrote her and I was like, yes, it would be my pleasure to write you a book. How do we get that ball rolling? And then we had some conversations over the next couple months. And then lo and behold...
Just because I promised we would, this title, Mother, Wife, Sister Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. Huh?
Yeah, right. Okay, so I did a tweet a couple years ago where I said, you know, I love when people's Twitter bios are like Mother, Wife, Sister Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. Because people really do that. If you look at people's bios on social media, especially celebrities, they want to show like another side of them. They want to show some whimsy, which is one of my least favorite things in the world.
Whimsy, yeah, he said.
You have to hit the H hard on there. And so people will do that, you know, particularly like a celebrity, you know, somebody, you know, like a football player will be like, you know, proud dad, you know.
I'm totally going to have to go change my I forget well, what mine is right now. Oh,
here's
my
the thing.
God.
It's fine,
like,
of course,
back.
That they do that. It's just when people like to show other sides of themselves, here I am, comedian, to squash that and make fun of it. So, and then also make fun of myself.
Rob Delaney, the book is called Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. I almost messed it up. Rob, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
These final notes on the way out today, yes, two of them, data points, really, about the state of the American economy. The first comes to us from the Wall Street Journal, which happened upon some research showing the percentage of Americans over the age of 16 who say they don't want a job, don't want one at all. Any guesses? Anyone? All right, here you go. 34.3% of us over the age of 16, that is, don't want a job at all. And this, which is related, although I can't figure out exactly how. Tim Fernholz, the reporter at Quartz that we talk to from time to time, did a little research this afternoon after the insider trading plea deal by SAC Capital. The $1.2 billion fine the company is going to pay will lower the net worth of its owner and founder, Stephen A. Cohen, SAC Capital. You get it? Anyway, it's going to lower his net worth enough to move him from being the 43rd richest American all the way down to the 59th richest American. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow tacked on 23 points. That's about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ added 14 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 3/10 of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.